champagne taste with a Coors Light budget. I think the biggest misconception people have is that style is unattainable. Through 15-second Instagram and Snapchat stories, we have subconsciously trained our brains to believe that in order to keep up with the Kardashians in the style department, we have to have access to an unlimited Amex Black card or be an A-lister with Glam Squad. In some ways, you're right. As we speak, there are teams of stylists curating color-coordinated rolling racks up and down the hallways of museum-inspired Calabasas mansions. But I need you to hear me out when I tell you. Style does not equal money. And you also better believe that money does not equal style. Although my closet has enough letter logos to make Sesame Street jealous, I truly don't believe that's what makes me stylish. For me, fashion comes from a place of lack. Growing up, my family was poorer than the average family, which for us meant my mom would make our clothes. She knew how to sew, so she could inexpensively make us what we needed, especially matching outfits, always with the mommy and me matching outfits. I was never given new clothes as a child, and that bugged me to the point where it became an obsession. I also had this fabulous aunt, Mary, who was the complete opposite of my mom. Mary was in pharmaceutical sales and was always dating really wealthy men. She had an entire room in her house that was a closet. And I remember thinking, this is going to be my life. I may have also thought about how it would be amazing to own all these clothes and bags, but mainly I knew that one day, on my own dime, I would have a room filled with my dream wardrobe. But I didn't have a sugar daddy, at least not at the time. And I wasn't exactly raking in the cash from Taco Bell and Sonic, so I had to get creative. I started swiping clothes from my sister Alicia, who's 5 years older than me and ran with a much different crowd. Her cool girl drill team friends were all super loaded and were always loaning her things from their own closets, which I would alter on my mom's Singer sewing machine. I also quickly learned that I could buy clothes cheap at Ross or TJ Maxx, then work my tailoring magic to make them sluttier and shorter and cooler, styling them up and mixing and matching the pieces to mimic trends I'd seen in the magazines at 7-Eleven. And I learned that you can never really tell the difference between a $5 dress and a $500 dress, which gave me confidence that if I did it right, no one would know that I barely had any money in my clothing budget. I still have the same sense when I style myself now. In fact, I pride myself on it. I'm hella resourceful. Let's just say Nordstrom has a killer return policy that I took full advantage of when shooting season one, buying and returning dresses for shoot days since I didn't have endless amounts of money. Or I'll put on a $20 dress and pair it with a Rolex, mixing things up, high and low. Or you know what? Fuck the Rolex, because the accessory that really makes you look expensive is your attitude. If you carry your outfit with confidence, then no one's going to come at you. Be your own icon. Remember Christina Aguilera back in her chaps, skimpy bras as tops, and morning after makeup days? Coming off the cookie cutter train of the Mickey Mouse Club, she was surrounded by pop culture robots like Jessica Simpson, Mandy Moore, Justin Timberlake, and Willa Ford. These performers played it safe and pleased the big music executives, along with their fans' approving mothers, but not Christina Aguilera. While people applauded Britney Spears' virginity vows, Christina never bothered to deny her sex life nor defend what really went on backstage at the Mickey Mouse Club. With murmurs of sex and alcohol behind the scenes, Christina was never one to sugarcoat things. She was ahead of her time in the 21st century feminist movement, so people were definitely not ready when she came out with her sex-positive Dare to Go There Dirty video. They were freaking the fuck out. But Christina was like, I don't care. I'm confident enough to love and embrace my sexuality, so take it or leave it. We'll take it, Xtina. She was always authentic to who she was, and I respect that. When asked about this iconic cultural moment, which was really like her coming out party, she said she didn't want to play the pretend to be innocent game. She wanted to be honest and truthful. She called Dirty her bucket moment. It was for her stepping up, owning the strength and the many forms it took on for her. Is she a boss bitch or what? The Kardashians also come to mind for me when I think about people with unapologetic style. From day one of Keeping Up with the Kardashians, I've always been particularly drawn to Khloe. For me, she was the different one. And as you know now, I can totally relate to feeling that way. But more than that, she would say exactly what she was thinking, popular or not, regardless of whether she thought people would agree. She's continued to set herself apart with her style. I mean, that queen basically invented knee-high boots and hoop earrings. And she continued to come out on top by staying true to herself and her personal style. Once you really know who you are, don't be afraid to express yourself with what you wear. This is your official permission, as if you need it, to really let it fly. Whether that means leather chaps, yes, or something more understated. In style, as in all other areas of your life, make it your own. Sense a theme yet, bitches? While writing this book, I shared the following quote on Instagram. The day I changed was the day I stopped trying to fit in a world that never really fit me. I posted it alongside photos of me that were taken while I was filming Selling Sunset. I was wearing a hot pink houndstooth print midi dress, a sparkly Gucci barrette, and black sky-high platform Mary Janes. This is actually kind of a big deal because I didn't always have the confidence to dress the way I do at work. When I first started out in real estate, I had no idea what I was doing. I'll be the first to self-own, and that's what was up. I was clueless, and not in the cute plaid suit and thigh-high kind of way. Since I was coming off working as an actress, I thought about it like playing a part. As in, the lead role of successful realtor will be played by Christine Quinn. I just needed a little costume. Well, you know those real estate mailers you get that feature a woman with her arms crossed over the reasonable plain Jane navy or black blazer? That's what I believed I had to wear if I wanted to make it. I went shopping at BB and got myself a rotation of pantsuits and silk camis to mix and match. I spent all this money to look the way I thought I needed to look, even posing for a group photo for the Oppenheim website with my arms crossed over my own black blazer. It was only a matter of time before I had my very own cheesy bench ad. But here's the thing. No matter how hard I tried to convince myself that this was the right thing to do, it didn't feel right. It was so not me. And feeling uncomfortable and awkward in my clothes did nothing for my confidence. I'd actually taken a step backward, becoming a carbon copy dime a dozen real estate agents with nothing special or unique to offer. Then, an interesting shift happened. At the time, I was single, and for the first time in a while, I was going out a lot to bars and restaurants to meet new people. When it came up in conversation that I was a real estate agent, I started landing clients. But I wasn't wearing the standard issue real estate blazer when I did it. No, I was dressed like the real me. Boobs to the sky, made by Mattel style all the way. Wait a minute, I remember thinking. I'm dressed like a hoochie mama at the bar, and you're telling me that you're trusting me with your listing? And just like that, it became clear to me. I could be myself and wear what I wanted and still succeed. In fact, I was succeeding because I was being much more authentic, which translated into more confidence and, well, more me. In my real estate flyer outfits, I wasn't telling the truth about who I was. It's why I love when people come at me for saying I'm fake. Do not get this twisted. I'm more real and genuinely me than I've ever been before. Playing dress up as someone else, on the other hand, was pure counterfeit. I'd love to tell you that I immediately dropped off all my blazers at Goodwill and started showing up to work in my favorite Hervé Léger dress, but it was a much more gradual change than that. At first, I slid the BB blazers off to one side of the closet. Then I started experimenting with outfits that I actually felt good in at work. Day by day, I got the validation that I was moving in the right direction. No one respected me less for being me. In fact, they respected me more. And my business, which is dependent on making genuine connections with people and developing trust with them, has never been stronger. Once you've grounded your personal style in who you are and what you stand for, then the capabilities are endless. When you make that connection between how you feel inside and what you look like on the outside, that's a really powerful shift. What you need to realize, though, is that the clothes aren't going to change how people think of you. You wearing the clothes like a boss is what will. That said, after you've ascended the style ranks and you're feeling yourself harder than Xtina herself, there are people who may come for you, because they always do. That leads me to our next lesson. Fuck the haters. After Selling Sunset aired, I get comments like, "You look like a stripper." And they didn't mean that as a compliment, even though I took it that way. Shout out to all my sex worker bitches who hustle and look good doing it. And now that I've had a baby, I get even more commentary and hateration about the way I choose to express my style. I've lost count of the number of times I've heard, "You're a mom, why are you dressing like that?" What, now that I've given birth, it's illegal for me to wear a mini dress? I have to shrivel up and move to sweatsuit town? Though, for the record, I can rock the shit out of a sweatsuit. And you can too, if that's your speed. The point is I refuse to change my style just because I'm a mother now. And I double refuse to allow people to shame me for the way I dress. No matter how someone comes at me and the way I choose to express myself, I have the same response for them. Thank you. That's right. I thank them. When I walked into the Oppenheim Group office in my fabulous neon green outfit and Heather told me I look like the Joker, I agreed with her. "Thank you," I said. "I feel like it. And I don't care what anyone has to say about what I'm wearing. The fact that they're talking about it means I'm doing something right. I don't expect everyone to have taste or to understand me, so I truly don't care what they think, and you shouldn't either. Say thank you and move on with your much more fabulous life." A friend of mine who worked at a celebrity magazine had a very minimalist style. She wore lots of black. A tiny black tank top layered under a cardigan or jacket was usually one of her go-to looks, and she always accented her outfits with delicate jewelry. Her boss, the fashion director at the magazine, once gave the staff accessories as gifts, and she chose the simplest of the pieces for my friend. "This one is for you because you are so minimal and simple, like Jennifer Aniston with all your plain tank tops." It's unclear whether she meant this as a dig or not. She probably did. But you know what my friend said? "Thank you." If someone's commenting on your style, it's because they noticed it. And that, quite simply, means you're winning. The world is full of haters. We know this. And yeah, We can talk about how to defend ourselves against the nastiest, wordiest internet trolls. But instead, I want to move beyond that to the next level of living and being. And on that level, life is aglow with the power of positivity. I'm not getting cheesy on you, I swear. Positivity, especially when you pay it forward, is super powerful, especially as you start to feel more comfortable in your own skin. Coming out as a bigger, better, stronger version of you can be scary in the beginning. Hell, even when you're a master at it like me. But what you need is to feel like there are people who have your back. And the best way to create more positivity in your life is to hand it out yourself and then surround yourself with the people who do the same. I have a really great group of confident women who are my friends, including total rock stars I admire, like Khloe Kardashian, Mindy Kaling, Lisa Rinna, Lily Galici. We support one another in real life and online, writing positive comments on each other's photos. You'd be amazed how simple, "You look amazing," goes such a long way. In a time when it's so much easier to cut people down, celebrities are often easy targets. The world needs more Khloes and Mindys and the positivity they bring. It's incredibly rare to be a woman in this culture who feels confident in herself and realizes that she's not in competition with anyone else. Let me say that again for you bitches in the back. No one else is your competition. We all have the same goal. We all just want to stand a little taller, be a little more confident, and feel at home in our own skin. So we need to be lifting each other up rather than cutting each other down. I want you to practice this in your own life. Every day for the next week, I want you to pick a woman online or in real life and give her a genuine compliment. Maybe she has a great smile or has fabulous shoes or chic sunglasses. Whatever you like about her style, tell her. Repeat this with a new woman each day. Imagine if everyone reading this book took the time to do that, and then the people receiving the compliments paid it forward. Let's go, bitches. We're doing this. Chapter 4. Work, bitch. This chapter is all about work, because if there's one environment where every girl I know could use a big shot of boss bitch energy, it's in the office. It doesn't matter if you're a hairdresser, a teacher, an ER doctor, or a partner at Big Dick and Big Dick and Big Dick. It doesn't even matter if you're a stay-at-home mom or someone who is still looking for the job of their dreams. If you have a hustle of any kind, then you need to treat it with the same authenticity and ownership that you do everything else in your life. Because stepping into that power is the secret to success and ultimately loving the life you live. I know this might come as a surprise coming from the girl with no college degree who's gotten fired, or what I like to think of as mutual parting ways, from pretty much every job she's ever had since she was a teenager, but I know a thing or two about making it work. The lessons I learned weren't on any fancy B-school syllabus. And honestly, having to scrap and hustle my way from the bottom taught me more about how to fend for myself at the office than any chick will get from Wharton. Fuck, they should pay me to teach a course there. Can you imagine? Seriously, call me. My approach is a no-fail mix of standing in your power mixed with common sense and a healthy dose of fuck you attitude. Within reason, of course. We're all still professionals. But part of that is knowing when to walk away if something's no longer working for you. And the key to all of this is, that's right, channeling your inner boss bitch. Bitch, stop apologizing. There's this amazing movie called A Simple Favor. Seriously, so good. And it stars Blake Lively and Anna Kendrick. Blake plays this badass bee who's a total fucking sociopath. She meets Anna's character through their kids' school, and Anna's this goofy girl next door who's always stumbling and fumbling and apologizing. Finally, Blake goes, "Never say sorry. It's a fucked up female habit." Goddamn right. Why do we women always apologize? Especially at work. If you pay attention, you'll notice that almost every woman around you has a habit of saying sorry. A lot. It's almost like its own punctuation, or an empty word that gets tossed mindlessly into conversation for decoration. "Sorry, but I disagree." "Oh, sorry, I just had something to add." "I'm sorry I didn't respond to this sooner." "Sorry for the long email." But apologizing all the time isn't you being polite or kind in a way that makes people think more of you. The opposite is true. It minimizes you. It makes you seem less than. Like you don't value the way you think or act relative to the people around you. Like you instantly take back anything that you're saying that comes after "sorry," because you don't really mean it. Is any of that true? If not, stop acting like it. And if it is, well then, it's extra crucial that you keep listening and start being your best advocate. Because I see you, and I know you're more amazing than this basic ass shit. Saying sorry is an example of the people-pleasing that we're trained to do from the time we're little girls. Subconsciously, we think that adding "sorry" whenever we say anything gets us off the hook in case someone disagrees with us. And yes, even dressing the way we think we're supposed to dress and acting the way we think we're supposed to act, bland, submissive, is a form of apology. And trust me, I've been guilty of it too. Before I began working at the Oppenheim Group, I was interested in commercial real estate. During one interview, I felt like my potential employer was not only surprised, but also intimidated by the way I was speaking. It was almost unfathomable to this egotistical, over-tanned, dried-up raisin of an executive that a 20-something-year-old woman was asking and answering all the right questions, and doing so on the same level as his Centrum Silver popping golf buddy is discussing business at their local country club. After all, women my age were usually only on the golf course to serve those men their Arnold Palmers or as arm candy with their asses hanging out of their golf skirts, which isn't a look I'm totally down on, but no need to get distracted from the point. I could tell that he was intimidated by me. He was clueless as to how someone half his age, a woman no less, was speaking to him as an intellectual and professional equal. I apologized in my own way by dumbing myself down and retreating. Afterward, even though I knew that I'd never work for him and that I was the Elle Woods to his Warner Huntington III, I was disappointed in myself for making myself smaller for someone else. Luckily, I quickly realized that if I was going to succeed, I need to work with men who weren't threatened by the real me. And while we're here, let's not forget the apologies that we make for our success and power too. Men are encouraged, if not expected, to seize their power, to own it, to walk into a room and command it, knowing their worth, bragging about their accomplishments and waving around their conquests. It's called big dick energy for a reason. Women, on the other hand, aren't raised to do that. So we need to catch up on a steep learning curve. We may have been taught that boys don't like girls like that, but do we really want to catch a man who can't handle a little pussy power? I said it, and I'll say it again, all over chapter 5. There might be a lot of things you're expected to do at work as part of your job, but making other people more comfortable is not one of them. Now, there will obviously be times when you're truly sorry for something and an apology is due. In these cases, Yes, owning up and genuinely apologizing is the classy thing to do. And it's all the more reason to stop throwing away all those other half-assed sorries so people can start taking you more seriously when you say and mean the real thing. Get bitchy. Quitting the sorry habit starts with actually realizing how much you say it. Pay attention to how many times a day you say the word sorry. Literally, keep track on a sheet of paper, on the notes app in your phone, or wherever you can keep a solid count. Do that for at least a week, or possibly a few weeks, however long it takes for you to start to see a pattern emerge. Can you identify in what settings or situations you tend to apologize unnecessarily? That's the first step to changing a habit. Maybe you say, sorry, as the opener to most of your emails and texts since you feel like you're perpetually behind. I'm so sorry I didn't get back to you. Or, I'm sorry, I just saw this message, blah, blah, blah. This is actually a pretty easy fix. Just delete the opener and go right into the intended body of the message. Or sub in a personal note if the situation calls for it. Like, it was great seeing you last week. Hope you enjoyed your time off. Beyond that, chances are that, one, no one even noticed that that email or text was missing, and two, no one cared if they did. And they definitely don't need a long, drawn-out explanation in place of a sorry. Get to the point. For most of you, meetings with your coworkers are where you're going to rack up the most S-word infractions. Maybe it's just a tick that you can eventually cut out now that you're aware of it. But maybe it's something deeper. A result of feeling inadequate at work, or like you're going to risk stepping on toes if you assert yourself or your ideas. Explore that. Pay attention to how other people at the office communicate with each other. Do you see the men doing the same thing at meetings? Or your boss, male or female? My guess is no. Then do an experiment. Challenge yourself to speak up without an apology, in your language or in your tone. How are your ideas received? How do you feel afterward? My money's on really fucking good. Or, if you're in a situation where you feel like you really do have to change who you are or the way you speak to suit someone else, and that by being authentic you would risk losing your job, think long and hard about what that means for you. Think through what the worst case scenario would be if you started to make small shifts in your behavior, no longer accommodating this toxic person or situation. Would it really be that bad, particularly if it meant that you'd no longer be cramming yourself into an unreasonably small box? We'll talk more about when it's time to walk away from a situation, but for now, meditate on that. Fake it. There are these moments in your life when you have to make a choice between real and fake. Relationships? Real. Bags? Real. Money? Real AF. Face? Dealer's choice. But work? That's when you can make fake work for you. As I mentioned earlier, it's one of the best pieces of advice I ever got from my dad. Fake it till you make it. I put this baby to the test when I was first trying to get a job and had zero experience. I faked having bartending experience. What, like it's hard? And may have fudged my resume. Who are we kidding? That thing was a greater work of fiction than Moby fucking Dick. I leaned on it every time I went into an audition, hoping my cool confidence could convince a director to take a chance on an inexperienced actress. And I've reached for it again and again throughout my professional life in order to get where I wanted to go, even if I had no idea what I was doing. When I was a baby real estate agent, I had a lot to learn. but I didn't think acting helpless and confused was a cute look. So I took a page from my dad's playbook. It made sense to me. I'd been acting since I was a little girl, pretending and trying on characters. I loved making movies with my video camera, directing my dolls, doing photo shoots, and generally being creative. And while I didn't know at the time what it was all adding up to, I knew that I had the power to make people feel a certain way, and I loved that. Since then, I've always had fun with pretending, and what I realized is that after a while, my brain wouldn't really know the difference. The result would be a genuine embodiment of whatever character I was trying on, which is a clutch skill to have if you're trying to make it as an actress. And, as it turns out, can also be helpful when you're trying to play the part of boss bitch. In real estate, that meant that first I had to dress the part, or at least what I thought was the right costume at the time. Then I made my reel for the role of killer real estate agent. The way I saw it, I could either let everyone know how inexperienced I was or just not. It wouldn't hurt anyone to fudge the truth, and I always got people where they needed to go, but maybe in a more roundabout way. If a client asked me a question and I didn't know the answer, I'd say with complete authority that that's a great question. I will find that out and get back to you right away. Or at open houses, when people were always drilling me with all kinds of questions, I'd give them my best guess and follow up later if I got it wrong. For example, if they asked me what year the house was built and I didn't really know, I'd give them an educated guess. Unbeknownst to them, look it up later, then shoot them a text. It was great seeing you today in my open house. I just wanted to follow up and let you know that the house was actually built in 2002, not 1996. Please let me know if you have any other questions. First of all, it was kind of a genius hack, if you think of it, giving myself a reason to follow up with potential buyers. And second, even the most experienced real estate agent doesn't know everything. I didn't need to make them feel awkward or undercut my credibility by apologizing, lethal mistake number one, or explaining that I'm new and I don't know anything, lethal mistake number two. I wanted to be taken seriously, so I acted seriously. The best way to fake it is to find someone you admire and do your best impression until you become the real thing. It can be someone you see at the gym, at the office, on social media, in the tabloids, or on TV. Mwah? Get all Marvel with that shit. Think the Black Widow would tweak over not knowing how to load paper in the fucking copy machine? Then examine what makes that person tick. Is it the way they walk, talk, dress, move their body, deal with conflict? Who is this person? Their motivation? What do they sound like, look like? Then take those same qualities and adapt them to your own life. This souped-up version of you is now your boss bitch alter ego. She doesn't have to come out all the time, but she's who you call upon when you want to get shit done. Paris Hilton is a prime example. She built an entire career around a character that she's really not, but knows people love, and she has a lot of fun doing it. Look at her cooking show where she acts like she's really stupid and can't scramble fucking eggs. This bitch has a billion-dollar perfume line and 32 companies. You think she's really that dumb? Of course not. She's really smart. But she plays into this character because it gives her an edge that's helped her succeed. For me, my alter ego is someone I invented. Her name is Svetlana, and she's even more of a no-bullshit assassin than I am. She's who I channel when I go to work and I need to slay. She loves rich men, richer women, Italian sports cars, and stilettos, and she definitely has a way with a whip. It's okay if you don't feel like this person on the inside. That's actually the point of the exercise. The more you try to emulate this person, the more their qualities will soak into your brain until it feels more natural to call upon these superpowers anytime you need them. Ask the damn questions. Another common trap that women fall into at work or in business is the fear of looking stupid or incompetent, and so they don't ask for help or dig deeper to get to the bottom of a situation. When I took the real estate licensing exam, it included questions like, who passed the lead law in 1978? And how far do sex predators have to stay away from a neighborhood community? Not exactly applicable to the day-to-day of working in real estate. I did what I needed to do to memorize the answers for the test. But then, when I started having actual real estate transactions cross my desk, I had no idea what I was doing. There was a seemingly endless amount of paperwork, and none of the rando answers I learned from my test came close to helping. At first, I was too afraid to ask because I hated the feeling of being the new girl, and I was self-conscious about what people would think of me. How things have changed. But I literally couldn't do my job until I worked up the courage to do it. I finally asked some of my colleagues about it, but no one seemed willing or able to help. They just shrug and go back to what they were doing. It was kind of weird. Then I asked my boss, Jason, and he said, well, don't worry about it. That's what Angelica and Eric are for, referring to the office associates who are in charge of the paperwork. Leave it for them to handle. I told Jason that I wanted to do it myself, if only to understand how the entire process works. I wanted to see firsthand all the different levels of a real estate deal. But I pay those people a salary to do that stuff, Jason said, clearly starting to lose patience with me. You don't have to do it yourself. He wasn't going to get it. So I pivoted and went to my coworker, Nicole, and told her that on my latest deal, I wanted to do every step of the sale myself. She was incredibly helpful and taught me how to do each and every piece. I asked for help, and as a result, I came away with a much more detailed understanding of the sale process than a lot of my competitors or coworkers. I didn't love having to admit that I didn't know something, and I definitely didn't love being talked to like I didn't have the ability to understand, but in the end, I came out on top. Sometimes you just have to take your ego out of the equation. If we don't ask for help, or don't ask questions so we can learn how to do a better job at whatever it is we do, then we're only holding ourselves back. Do you ever find yourself Googling excessively before you dare ask a colleague how to do something at work? Do you feel like people will think you're dumb if you ask? Well, consider this. If a man were asking another man a question at work, the exchange would probably sound something like this.
Yo, bro, show me how to use the thing. Yeah, bro, I'll show you, no problem, bro.
Ass slaps all around and scene. You don't have to make a big deal out of it, and you definitely don't have to apologize. You just have to have the balls to say, hey, you know what? I need you to teach me how to do this so I can do it myself. This is about much more than just a confidence issue. Because when you ask for help, you're also learning, which means you're getting better at your job, which means you're getting that much closer to being not just a boss bitch, but the boss. And even the boss needs to learn a few things from time to time, too. People are going to have opinions about you and judge you regardless. Why not further your career in the process? And I promise, the more you do speak up and ask for what you need at work, the less uncomfortable you'll be doing it. Another angle of the same issue is being afraid to raise questions in a situation where you need to be an advocate for yourself. especially when navigating a business deal. I learned that the hard way when I was working as an actress. I had my manager who discovered me. Yeah, I know, it's so annoying and cheesy when people are like, I got discovered in a mall. But I really did get discovered. He reached out to me after I did my first movie, Shark Night 3D. His name was Rob, and his specialty was bringing in new talent and developing their career. From the very beginning, we had an amazing relationship. He'd pushed me when I was doubting myself, telling me things like, shut the fuck up and do it, or don't forget who you are, come on. And we'd bicker like an old married couple, like, fuck you, talk tomorrow, love you, bye. He was the godfather meets dance moms, and I loved it. He was a powerful motivator, and he recognized my value. We worked together for years, and he even met my family. During that time, he got me so many great opportunities to the point where he really put me on the map, and people knew who I was. Eventually, I was approached by a huge agency. We're talking top five, and they wanted to represent me. They told me that they really wanted to work with me, took me out to fancy dinners, gave me the whole schmooze and booze. I was so dazzled by everything that they were promising that I decided to sign with them and let Rob go. Well, I ended up sitting on their roster forever because I was just one of tons of other girls just like me who were represented at the agency. Until I finally got one job. And it was huge. It was such a big role and opportunity that I never stopped to ask any questions about it. I just flew out to Miami and shot my scenes with these huge celebrities. Then they wanted me to do a scene I wasn't really that comfortable with and didn't realize I had to do it because I never even thought to have asked, but I went ahead and did it because I was too afraid to say no. And after all that, my part got cut down to that one scene. I called my agent and I was like, what the fuck is this? And his only response was, you got paid. What's your problem? That's business. I was heartbroken, just totally shattered. Not only had I gone against my gut and turn my back on someone who genuinely cared about me. Another big lesson in business, your intuition is everything. But I never once stopped to ask some really important questions that would have prevented me from getting into this mess in the first place. I should have been asking my new agents what they had in mind for my career, or what kind of roles they saw me in, or whether they'd let me do a 2-week trial. But I committed a double whammy business sin. I was too afraid to ask, and I hadn't done my homework. What you need to realize is that asking questions doesn't make people think that you don't know your shit. It's the opposite. Drilling people with relevant questions shows them that you know your stuff and that you care enough to get the answers. And what's even more important is that now you have all the information you need to make an educated decision that protects your best interest. The most valuable asset you have is your intuition. And if you're not getting all your facts, you're not going to be able to fully assess a situation and weigh in with what your gut is telling you. Go the extra mile. When I was the new girl at the Oppenheim Group and just starting out in my real estate career, I was always looking for ways to set myself apart. I mean, struggling actress turned real estate agent isn't exactly the most novel storyline here in LA. I quickly figured out that what I lacked in experience, I could make up for in hustle with a splash of flair. Because while I may have had a lot to learn, no one works harder than me. The first order of business was practice, practice, practice. Anytime someone needed to babysit an open house, I'd volunteer. Any grunt work in the office, I'd gladly take it on. I was like that annoying summer intern hopped up on cheap coffee and dreams of greatness. Except instead of running around like some clueless little puppy dog, I was on a mission. Oh, and I don't do coffee runs. I didn't think of it as paying my dues or like it was doing bitch work. Instead, I looked at the challenges of my new career through the lens of opportunity. I also brought a healthy dose of optimism. I truly believed that my next client was just around the corner. If I so much as made eye contact with a new person in my first few weeks on the job, then they got one of my business cards. And those business cards didn't come cheap. The company had them specially made with a personalized metal mold and thick paper embossed with our name and number. I didn't really have the money for them at the time, but I sucked it up and charged them to my credit card because I knew they'd legitimize me, at least in my own mind. And as we know by now, when something takes root in your brain, it's only a matter of time before it comes real on the outside. As soon as my cards arrived, I got to work meeting people. Whether it was at yoga class or happy hour, I'd meet someone, we'd chat, then I'd say, "Here, let me give you my card," handing over this little tailored, thoughtful extension of me. Not only made me feel legitimate and luxe, it was also the first important step toward getting my name out there and meeting people who would ultimately become clients. The next step for me was to take on open houses and own them as my own personal projects. This wasn't hard to do because no one at the brokerage really wanted to do them. Open houses were held every Sunday and Tuesday, and it's a 3 or 4 hour deal each time. You don't get paid to do it, and there's no guarantee that anyone coming in to see the house will make an offer to buy it. But I hoarded them. I took a pile of Jason's listings and offered to sit each and every open house. This was my best chance to practice in my new line of work. When people walked into one of these properties, they didn't know it was Jason's listing. It didn't matter. I was the person sitting there, so I got to answer their questions and rehearse my agent skills. "Hi, welcome to such and such address. Let me tell you all about the home. It's a 4,000 square foot, 5 bedrooms, 4 bathrooms. I'll show you around." To me, it felt like acting, or even being a kid and playing again. It was fun for me. And by doing that over and over, I felt more confident in my skills as an agent. I'm so grateful for all those hours spent at open houses because they accelerated how quickly I advanced in my career and helped me get to the place of true confidence faster. Once I started getting my own listings, I had all this experience behind me that I wouldn't have had if I never volunteered for all that work that no one else wanted to do. At the same time, calls started trickling in from people who had my fancy business card in their wallets, even months later. I'd get a voicemail like, "Hi, we met back in the winter at that dance class, and I thought of you because I'm getting ready to sell my house." All those early stage bursts of effort began to pay off, and it was time to take things to the next level. When I started doing open houses for my own listings, I wanted to make them feel special. So at one of the very first, I brought cupcakes for people who came in to tour the property. Jason stopped by and looked confused. "Why do you have cupcakes?" he asked me. "Oh, it's just something I thought people would like," I said. "Well, you don't have to do that," he told me. "I know I don't have to," I replied, "but I want to." I get where he was coming from. Most agents would just show up with flyers, maybe some bottles of water. But to me, those little touches mattered. It personalized my open houses, and I truly believed that people would remember them. I'd bake cookies and light candles. I also read that in Chinese culture, it's good luck to have fruit in the kitchen. So I would put out bowls of oranges or lemons. I wanted to create an ambiance that would help people feel like they were already home. There was no way to quantify whether it worked. People don't put down an offer on a home and tell you, you know, it was those amazing scented candles that really sealed the deal. But subconsciously, I'm willing to bet that the extra effort stood out to people. Going the extra mile also meant thinking outside the box on some occasions. One of my first clients was a woman who came through one of my open houses. She was this high-profile boss bitch who told me that this particular listing wasn't right for her, but she explained what she was looking for instead. "Do you have an agent?" I asked her. She didn't. I told her I'd love to help her find a home. I was so excited to finally have a client of my own. I did so much work for her, took her on nearly a dozen private showings, and I looked at new listings on the MLS real estate database for her daily. We even started to become friendly, and she invited me to a party at her house. Then, one day, I got a text from her about a property that I definitely hadn't taken her to see. "Thanks so much for showing me the house. I'd love to put an offer on it," she wrote. The text wasn't intended for me. She was working with another real estate agent. This was a heavy blow. Truly, it felt like I just caught my significant other cheating. The audacity! I thought that she and I had formed a relationship, and I had no idea that she was working with someone else behind my back. I eventually found out that the other agent had shown her an off-market property, and that's the one she offered on. So while it definitely stung, personally and professionally, it was an important lesson for me to learn. I had to think outside the box in this business and know that I had plenty of competition, some of which I couldn't even see. In every job, you can do things by the book, or you can be prepared to go off script. After my high-profile client bought a house through another agent, I knew I had to get more creative. I started talking to developers in order to get the inside track on up-and-coming properties before they even hit the market. I set up lunches and meetings with my rich friends to get a sense of what sort of properties were off the market and outside of the MLS. I could have taken this blow as a major setback and written it off as better luck next time. Instead, I decided to go out and make my own goddamn luck. And you better bet that it paid off. Anyone in any type of career can go the extra mile and put in a little more work up front. At minimum, you'll learn more and more quickly. But beyond that, the possibilities are endless, especially if you're thinking how to apply your own personal spin. Those touches are what bring your brand to what you do. And even though you might be selling the same cars as the chick one lot over, or offer the same accounting service as any other CPA in town, no one can do what you do the way you do it. Going the extra mile in the spirit of your personal boss bitch style is a surefire way to amp up the value of your stock. I want you to revisit the five boss languages, specifically the one that you matched with on the quiz in Chapter 2. Now, think about the values and attributes that are unique to your archetype and how you can hook them up with your regular business offerings to make yourself stand out. For example, if you're an executive boss bitch, your extra mile might be offering a no bullshit, always punctual approach to your work among competitors who maybe take a beat too long to answer their texts and emails or follow up on business requests. creative boss bitches could think about adding a splash of color or graphic interest where other boring boss bitches are only dreaming in black and white. Matriarch boss bitches can add the special touch of making sure everyone feels taken care of, offering a signature drink or snack, taking a more personable approach instead of a slicker sell. Now, think of how you personally can take that up a notch. For me, it was the cupcakes at the open house and the business cards printed on stock so nice it was yummy. Could you design a newsletter that goes out to clients or potential clients? Have a stack of tailor-made business cards with your own personal logo? It doesn't necessarily have to be expensive, but I guarantee if you dig deep for that extra flourish, it'll pay off. Be a quitter. I know it's a hot take, but I truly believe that in order to fully step into your power at work, you have to get comfortable with the idea of quitting if it really came down to it. Because walking away from something when it's no longer serving you is called having boundaries. And let me tell you, that's my second favorite B word. Boundaries mean you know exactly what you are and are not willing to do, and no one can trifle with that. Having boundaries is the same as having a code, a personal belief system, and that shit is powerful. Far too many women falsely equate quitting with failure, and that is simply not a belief that's going to serve you well in business. You will mostly have jobs that won't be the right fit for you, bosses who don't treat you well, or coworkers you don't vibe with. You have a choice. You can stay and talk yourself into being happy, or you can find something better, which you almost certainly will. So forget the old played out, don't be a quitter trope, and be open to the idea of getting the fuck out if need be. From a very young age, I was always able to say no. I knew my mind and wasn't afraid to speak it. It's such a simple two-letter word, but no is one of the hardest things that you can say to people. But I just intuited that I needed to say no and walk away from situations that I knew I didn't want to be in. And as a result, I learned early on the power of taking myself out of situations that didn't feel right, organic, or authentic to me. For example, I quit, or got fired, from nearly every job I had as a teenager because I was always standing up for myself. When I was 16 and working at Sonic, they introduced a rule that it would be mandatory for all employees to deliver food on roller skates. I said, "That's fucking dangerous. I don't want to break an ankle. I'm not a roller skater. I can't do that." But my boss told me that that was corporate policy and that I had to do it unless I had a doctor's note. I went home and forged a pretty good one, which lasted me for a while. But ultimately, they found out that I didn't have a legitimate medical excuse, and because I still refused to wear the skates, they let me go. I had a similar exit from Taco Bell when I was 15. I've always loved getting my nails done, and when I was working at the fast food chain, I spent $40 on a new set of acrylic nails. A lot of money to me back then. My nails had never been an issue, but one day my boss told me that they were a food hazard because one could inadvertently come off into the food. If I wanted to keep my job, I'd have to have my acrylics removed before coming back. So, I quit. Now, I know this might sound a little silly at face value. You quit your job over roller skates and a set of nails? But my job exits never came from a place of wanting to be rebellious. It came from not wanting to sell myself short for a job. For whatever reason, I was able to see that there would always be other options, that I should find a job that fit me and my needs and desires, and not the other way around. I brought the attitude with me into my acting career, and then eventually into real estate. When I first started acting, it was so much fun and really fulfilling. From the time I acted in my middle school plays, I always had a passion for performing. So doing it as my actual job seemed too good to be true. When I still lived in Dallas, I got cast in a movie called Shark Night 3D, which is when I officially caught the bug. I'd been modeling, but doing that movie changed everything. I moved to LA and started auditioning. During those years, I felt this deep excitement about the work. Every audition was an adventure, and I got a lot of parts. But after a while, the charm wore off, and the work was less available. I started to get typecast as the stereotypical dumb blonde. Auditions became fraught with the pressure of, if I don't get this job, what am I going to do? My heart wasn't in it anymore, and I began to resent the work because I primarily needed it for the money. More than anything else, I felt that familiar constraint on my freedom, the part of my life that I value the most. I wasn't in control of whether or not I would get cast. A casting director could be having a bad day or could have a better relationship with another actress or personal connections like the daughter of a friend of their mom. It happens. No matter how good I was, at the end of the day, did I really want to put my fate and future into the hands of a washed-up actress with a frizzy Fantastic Sam's blowout and 6 rescue cats? As the great poet Ariana Grande would say, thank you, next. I believe that as soon as you start resenting the thing that you once loved, it's time to move on. That carefree, nonchalant attitude I used to have was gone, and the fire died. My intuition told me it was time to make a change, and I knew that I didn't want to end up as one of those 40-year-old former soap opera actresses still trying to catch her big break. So, I pivoted. When I knew I was ready for a career move but didn't know what it would be, a friend introduced me to his friend, Jason Oppenheim. And trust me, it was the only good thing that came out of that friendship. Even I knew that he was a big name in the real estate business in Los Angeles. Still, I had my doubts at first. Trust me, my friend said. Real estate is all about people, and you're really good with people. You'll do great. I had lunch with Jason, and we got along well, and my interest in the business was piqued. Jason said, come back when you get your real estate license. Just the idea of taking the real estate licensing exam was pretty daunting. School wasn't my thing, especially thanks to my ADD. But I knew I had to buckle down and get over this hurdle if I wanted to try out working in real estate. So I got a prescription for Adderall and decided that if I was going to do this, I would need to pass the test as quickly as I could. The longer I drew it out, the longer it would be until I could make money or live life on my own terms. To be completely honest, I didn't have a particular affinity for real estate. Sure, I love a gorgeous house as much as the next flossy bitch. I mean, they're like models who don't talk back during fittings. But what I truly love is connecting with people and helping them. In this case, finding exactly what they want in a home. But the appeal for me went beyond the work itself. Being a real estate agent meant that I could go out and attract my own clients, choose who I wanted to work with, and be in control of how much work I did and when. And while Jason and his brother Brett owned the Oppenheim Group, and I was technically one of their employees, I still essentially worked for myself as an independent contractor living the 1099 life. In other words, real estate meant that I could maintain my freedom, which is what I value most in this world. Back to that exam. I studied the hell out of that test for 3 weeks. I sat down every night with flashcards that I made from myself, navigating a crash course in real estate that I invented using apps that I downloaded and Real Estate for Dummies. I'd order Pizza Hut for dinner and study, nothing else. It was actually the first time I took a test really, really seriously because I finally cared about the subject matter. And after all that work, I passed. I eventually found out that that was basically unheard of. I was told that most people take 3 to 6 months to get their license, and many don't pass the first time they take the test. But I was driven, and suddenly I had a whole new career. Thanks, Teva Pharmaceuticals! After years of learning the hard way that when I don't see the point in trying hard at something, I have zero motivation to do it. Reason 572 why high school didn't work out so well for me. I also learned to realize I don't get motivated from being bossed around or told what to do, only in the bedroom.